Hello, everybody, and welcome to F This Movie. Merry Christmas, happy holidays. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight for a very special episode of F This Movie, once again, by Eric Asperschlager.
I'm the most important person in the world.
You really are, because the show has your name in it.
Are we sure that the blogging software that you use can handle that many letters?
Here's the thing. My C character is broken.
Okay.
So we're going to have to talk about making some changes. So you're cool with that. It rolls.
Yeah,
it flows better, I feel like. You are listening to F This Movie, which you can find online at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/fthismovie, twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us in the iTunes store just by searching F This Movie or just typing in Best Movie Podcast. And you can find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdictpresents.com. Thank you to Michael Staley and everyone at DVD Verdict, which includes you, Eric, for carrying our show. And if you love everything that Eric Asperschlager says, and who doesn't, you can also hear him almost weekly on the Friday Filibuster podcast at dvdverdictpresents.com as well. And that's a very entertaining show.
Oh, thanks. Well, I'm sorry. Well, thanks isn't that entertaining. So just, I mean, everything that I say except for well, thanks, because that's kind of trite. And then the stuff you put a lot of pressure on me tonight, Patrick.
You turned a lot of people off to the Friday filibuster already. They haven't even given it a chance yet. And yet you're well, thanks.
Consarn it. Hopefully that brought a few people back, because consarn is pretty interesting, right? And that's the kind of sparkling wit you can expect on Friday Filibuster.
Every Friday at dvdverdict.com and dvdverdictpresents.com. We are still doing the run-up to our 100th episode, so we're talking about everybody's favorite movies. Tonight, obviously, with Eric, we will be talking about Doug's five favorite movies. I'm throwing him for a loop.
Yep. I mean, they're all sequels. Did you know that?
They're all sequels to the same movie, because Doug's five favorite movies are Police Academy.
Police Academy 2-7.
But you guys, like, what's a bad comedy that has eight sequels? You really got to go Police Academy.
I know, but the tough part is, which three do you leave off? Which three do you leave off? And you can't just say the last three, because that's cheap.
Those were the weakest, I feel like, though. Like, Mission to Moscow? Please. Please. It's no Assignment Miami Beach, is what I'm saying. Even though I don't care for Matt McCoy, because once Gutenberg left, I feel like he took a large piece of Police Academy with him. And a piece of me with him.
It's a movie about police who go to an academy.
And they
don't know much about Police Academy.
They have to keep going. Here's what I don't understand about Police Academy, and I think I heard somebody make this point recently on another podcast. Somebody pointed out, like, at the end of the first movie, theoretically, they graduate the police academy. Why do they keep having to go back into the police academy?
Because they're terrible.
Like, I understand. Part two, their first assignment. Okay, now they're officially police. But then, part three, they're, like, back in training, I think is what it's called. So they did so bad on their first assignment, they have to go back into training.
And there's Police Academy 4, Employee Review.
4 is, I think, Citizens on Patrol.
Yeah, that would be Citizens on Patrol.
And then Assignment Miami Beach. So clearly now they're on assignment. They're no longer in the academy. And then it starts to get fuzzy for me. Is 6 Mission to Moscow or is 6 City Under Siege?
Honestly, after 2, I have to start making up subtitles. I just don't remember. Although it's funny because if tonight's podcast were the top 5 movies I watched most as a kid, Police Academy 2 would be on my list.
Right? And I find myself quoting Police Academy 2. Not that often, but every once in a while I will say, not the new zoo, the old zoo, which is totally from Police Academy 2.
The weirdest place I ever saw Police Academy was in an airport in, I think, Scotland. It was playing on a TV. In like the waiting area. I don't know. It was great because
was it all dubbed? Was it dubbed into Scottish?
Yes, it was dubbed into Scottish.
Nice. So Bobcat Goldthwait had a Scottish accent.
He just said haggis a lot.
Nice. Did Michael Winslow do his sound effects in Scottish? A lot of bagpipes. A lot of Loch Ness.
A lot of Loch Ness effects. Miserliness. I don't know.
I'm out. I said bagpipes and Loch Ness, and then I bailed on the Scottish. The weirdest place I ever saw a Police Academy movie in the theater. I saw Assignment Miami Beach in a theater. It was second run because I was at an age where if it was – there was a theater in walking distance to my house, and if it was PG or PG-13, I went because it meant I could go to a movie. So I didn't care that it was – it had the words Police Academy and 5 in the title.
When you say second run, you mean it was so popular the first time it came out, exactly. They had to put it back in
the theaters. We could just get rid of this movie, but no, it needs – people need to see this the way it was meant to be seen on a big screen.
I'm pretty sure that obviously next year you have the big Titanic being re-released in 3D. Yes. And I think Police Academy 5 is after that, right?
I don't know if it's getting the 3D post-conversion, but yeah, it's definitely getting its anniversary re-release. By the way, the Titanic, the 3D Titanic trailer, which I have a lot of issues with, but at one point it says from James Cameron, I think the visionary director of Avatar, and it was like, wait, I remember when James Cameron was the visionary director of Titanic. What happened?
It's like a snake eating its own tail, eating a terrible movie. I'm not a fan of Titanic.
No, and the trailer is so weird because it's playing the Celine Dion love ballad while showing the destruction and people like falling and hitting their heads and dying on the way down. But we're supposed to feel like this is so romantic. I don't know.
Well, their heart will go on for a few more seconds anyway, right? After they hit the propeller. After that, it stops. But you got a window.
So once again, I should talk about our contest again, because as part of our 100th episode celebration, we're running a contest called the F This Movie Win Our Stuff Contest. You can read more about it at fthismovie.blogspot.com, or you can listen for the next 10 seconds as I talk about it. All it is email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Write about your favorite show, your favorite moment, write about that time that Patrick and Eric talked about Police Academy for 6 minutes. And we are going to be reading some of our favorite entries on the show. And then at the right, I think maybe before our 100th episode, we're going to throw a bunch of the entries into a hat and pull some out. And those people will win fabulous prizes. And by fabulous prizes, I mean DVDs from our collections that we no longer want. There is, of course, at stake a brand new Blu-ray of The Rocketeer, courtesy of TheRocketeer.net. Thank you so much to Joel Young for ponying up a brand new Blu-ray of a movie that's just now hitting Blu-ray. So everybody visit TheRocketeer.net. And in his column today, JB mentioned that he would be throwing in a Blu-ray of The Nightmare Before Christmas. So it's not all junk, is what I'm saying, depending on your feelings about The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Right. Now, do you have any of these entries to read this week, or was it just last?
Funny you ask, because I totally do. Like this now, one from Kathy.
I have a question before we begin. Are any of them about me, or can I go make a sandwich?
You should make maybe two sandwiches.
I am kidding. I want to hear these, because you know I'm not just a member. I'm also a client. I'm a big fan of this show. Listen for a long time. Well, so please, I want to hear.
All right, like this one from Kathy O'Brien, who says, my favorite moment, I think it was during the Plan 9 episode, and I think you're right, Kathy O'Brien, which was an all-around favorite, she says, was the story about Michael Jackson in the Count Orlok Nosferatu costume at the con. It was a story that JB told. If you don't remember it, go seek out our Plan 9 episode, which I believe was show number 50. Or this one from Ross Reeder, who says, I, Ross Reeder, nominate this small segment from the Goonies podcast as my favorite moment in all of F This Movie history. It's an excellent podcast because it reevaluates a perennial classic that does not quite hold up upon recent viewings. Now, I know this movie is beloved by children of the 80s and early 90s, but as a full-grown adult, can you honestly say The Goonies is good enough for you? See what he did there? It's not for me, nor is Hook. And then just throws Hook under the bus. Which I don't mind, because I don't like Hook either, but it's just funny that it's like, it's not for me. And by the way, neither is Hook at that movie.
It's a twofer.
So stop saying, hey, you guys, and chanting Rufio. How about rewatching Back to the Future or Raiders of the Lost Ark? You know, those other two non-crappy Spielberg movies of the 80s. Back to the Future and Raiders are just as amazing when you're 8 years old or 80 years old, which is something I think I almost said verbatim last week as Mark Ahn talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You said 9 or 90.
Did I?
Yeah, so.
Oh, man. I was wrong, because by 90, I feel like I'm going to poke holes in
Raiders. Honestly, 80, 85. Once you get beyond 1985, when you turn 85,
yeah,
then you start to disappear. I don't know. Keep reading. Shut me up.
So thank you for a serious, thought-provoking analysis of Goonies. I believe he's mischaracterizing our discussion of Goonies a little bit. And thank you, Doug, for surviving your encounter with a nacho cheese sword of death. Again, that's a story about Doug choking on a Dorito. You have to listen to the Goonies podcast. Thank you, Ross. Jason Craven says, my favorite F This Movie memory came back in August. I opened the F This Movie site and saw a new shitting on the classics post, Blade Runner. I couldn't believe it. My heart sunk. How can you shit on Blade Runner? But then I read the post and loved every word. And then he quotes the article. Instead, I would like to shit on the type of person who shits on Blade Runner. Classic. Love the blog. Love the podcast. Keep up the effing and the shitting. And, like, if you listen to the show, you know what that last sentence means. But if you don't, it's just like, what are you people doing?
No, you make the show sound a bit like a nature documentary. Right? Or some sort. It's a trip to the zoo.
It's horrible, just bodily functions, base, animalistic. But thank you, Jason, because that's not even about a podcast. That's about one of our articles, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Lastly, I will read from Dawn Hunt, who says, first of all, how can one choose? It's like choosing your favorite color of M&Ms. Near impossible, really. And by the way, the best color of M&Ms, tan. Tan is the answer, which they don't even make anymore.
Right, tan.
And maybe I'm romanticizing it because they don't make it. It's because I don't eat a lot of other tan foods, okay? That being said, I'll go with the one that makes me laugh over and over, the one I'll go back to if I need a pick-me-up. On the Top Gun podcast, the revelation of the Haverick. Anywho, I continue to love the show, as do all members of the F This Movie Nation. And I have to thank Dawn Hunt for coining the phrase F This Movie Nation, which nice. I feel like we are. Yes, the Haverick, again, you need to listen to the Top Gun podcast. It's a fake animal that Doug used to pretend to be. That he made up. Because it rhymed with Maverick.
It does.
It does.
I checked with our fact checker, and he's right.
We have a fact checker?
Yeah, it's Google.
He's part of it.
I mean, Lay. He's Portuguese.
So thank you, everybody, for those fantastic entries. We will have more entries on future shows. And remember, just by writing in your favorite memory, you make yourself eligible to win our stuff. Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, I have seen some. You know, I saw something that I wanted to see for a while, kind of a little bit, and then I heard that you loved it, and then I really wanted to see it, but by the time I knew that you loved it and wanted to see it, it was no longer on Netflix anymore, but now it's back.
Police Academy 5?
Police Academy 5.
Assignment Miami Beach. On training.
No, I finally got to see Matinee.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which is a great movie. You know, I remember seeing the commercials for it on TV.
During the 2 weeks that it was out?
Yeah, exactly. And you can never tell. It looked a little dumb, but it's totally not, I think, what the commercials made it seem like it would be. It's a really sweet, you know, story about – it's a sweet and moving story because it's about not only – kids and loving movies and the power of movies, but also actual, events in our nation's history that, mirrors what's going on in the movie really well. I found it really moving and, really kind of a throwback to the best of what the 80s had to offer for kids movies, even though it was, what,
1993?
Really? 93?
Yeah. Yeah, it ties so many things. It ties, just American history. It ties some movie history because you get to learn about sort of the gimmicks of the William Castle era. Mm-hmm. It ties together sort of this, sort of love letter to movies, which a phrase I hate because I'm hearing it so much about in discussions about Hugo now. It's like, oh, you should love Hugo. It's a love letter to cinema.
You don't have to worry about that too much longer. I hear the post office is going to close.
It's an email.
I love email. Too.
It's a text to cinema, a sext to the power of movies. But it's all these things rolled up into one. I just love that movie so much.
It's great to see Omri Katz getting more work after Erie, Indiana.
Absolutely. That guy does not work at all anymore,
really. I don't know. I think I'd recognize the name Omri Katz.
Yeah.
Is it Omri or Omri?
I believe it's Omri. And one of his friends, of course, one of the gang that Gene and Omri hang out with, is played by a guy named Joey Gonzalez, who my wife went to high school with.
Nice.
That's all. Just giving a little shout out to...
See, he was the
Jigons.
He was the big guy who was the producer who put all those movies out, right? And he
He was the guy. He's black and white, first of all, so that's an important thing to know about Joey Gunn. He's a little bit sensitive about it, so
he looks like a giant ant.
His head, yeah. Oh,
okay.
That would be
He was good.
That would be him. Matinee came out on Laserdisc, it was great because there was like a bonus feature that spliced together all of Mant, so you could basically watch Mant as one long feature. Yeah, it doesn't work as well.
No, it's too bad. I love the Mant footage in the movie because it's authentic and it's funny and it almost does what they did in Ed Wood, only a little bit better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It fits the spirit of the movie, but also totally harkens back to those kind of terrible movies where, you know, they're not, it's all about the effects and the shocks. It's not about the believability of the dialogue.
Right. anything besides Matinee?
Another movie I rewatched the movie Smoke. Have you seen that?
I have never seen Smoke. I'm familiar. It's Wang Wang, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, and this is a movie that I watched a bunch right about the time of some other movies that we're going to talk about tonight. So I sort of rewatched it, thinking, wondering, is it as good as I remembered? Might I put it on my list? And I'm not going to, because it's not quite as maybe didn't strike me as much now as it did then. But basically, it's a very it's a character piece, very strong acting. There's William Hurt and Harvey Keitel and Stockard Channing and even Harold Perrineau from Lost.
Sure.
A younger Harold Perrineau. Forest Whitaker. Just kind of the intersecting lives of all these people around a cigar shop in New York City, and has a lot to say about storytelling and art and all these kind of things. And it's written in a very literary way, in that everything everyone says sounds like it has been written and read as a short story kind of thing.
Right.
So it's effective, but it's very kind of a little bit too stylized in that way, and a little too kind of pretentious is not the word I'm looking for, because it's a well-made movie. It's a well-written movie. It just kind of feels a little bit stilted.
Okay.
The performances definitely make up for it. I mean, it's a lot of powerhouse performances in it. And it also is the movie that introduced me to Tom Waits. So I will. I'll credit at the very end. They over the closing credits and a little scene at the end, they play "Innocent When You Dream," the barroom version from Frank's Wild Years, which is
I have a weird relationship with Tom Waits because his music is so varied that there will be a song where I'm like, oh my gosh, that is so good, and then there's another one where I'm like, I can't turn this off fast enough. So
yeah, it's a this particular song is more melodic than a lot of.
Now, have you seen Blue in the Face?
No, did you just make that up?
I did not. Blue in the Face is like an unofficial, perhaps even an official sequel to Smoke. He made it maybe a year or two later with a lot of the same actors.
No, I have not seen it.
Okay, I don't know anything about it because I haven't seen either one. But if you're a fan of Smoke, I would say seek out Blue in the Face.
Right.
Anything else? Did you ever have a chance to watch Super 8? I know that you had ordered it.
I have not yet.
Okay.
I haven't actually. I have plans to watch it on Christmas Eve. So
nice. That's a good plan.
There are plans in place to watch it.
I like this plan. I have two movies that I'll talk about really quickly. One is called The Myth of the American Sleepover, which came out earlier this year and is available on Netflix Instant, and which I would suggest people maybe not watch, because it got some decent reviews. It's just about sort of these high school kids that takes place over this course of one night. There's like an all boys sleepover and an all girls sleepover, and then there's some crossover, and it's just their sort of romantic comings and goings, but it's done entirely with like maybe non-professional young actors, and it shows. There's basically one energy level through the whole movie, and it's slightly less dynamic than what I'm doing right now, if you can imagine that. I don't have a ton of positive things to say about it, except that it's very well photographed. The movie that I do want to encourage people to go see in a theater is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Whether or not you are a fan of the Mission Impossible series, Whether or not you're a fan of Tom Cruise, I think it's well worth people's time and money, especially to go see it in IMAX. It's playing, you know, for about a week early in IMAX, and then it comes out in sort of wide release. But a lot of footage in the movie was shot in IMAX. It was directed by Brad Bird, who has done only animation up to this point. This is his first live-action movie. And he shot a lot of the stuff in IMAX, including this incredible sequence that you've probably seen in some of the advertising where Tom Cruise is climbing the hotel in Dubai that is the tallest building in the world and the name of which is...
Empire State Building.
The Empire, the not Sears Tower. I don't know. I don't remember what it's called. It's an incredible sequence. And as I watched it, I could only think, give Tom Cruise all of the Oscars because what he's doing is amazing. The movie is a ton of fun if you like action movies at all. Again, you don't need to have seen the other movies. You don't even need to have liked the other movies because I rewatched all of them leading up to this one. And I have a difficult relationship with several of them. So I don't love them all, I guess is my point. But I thought the movie was really, really, really good. Just the best action movie I've seen in a long, long time.
Now, does that mean that you saw the Dark Knight footage as well? Or were you not at one of those theaters?
It was not at one of those theaters because the IMAX screen near me is not a true 70mm IMAX screen. So I did not see it, and I'm to tell you the truth, I'm kind of okay with that. Like, sure. I'm excited as anybody about the movie, but I can wait a few more months to see the first 6-7 minutes, you know what I mean? Like, it's not gonna make me more excited to see the movie. It's just gonna make me have to sit through the first 6 minutes again, I guess. I don't know, but they did show the new trailer, which of course hit the internet yesterday. And do you care to comment on the new trailer? Did you have a chance to see it?
Yeah, I saw it. It actually got me excited for the movie. It's not that I wasn't interested in the movie before. I kind of knew it would be worth seeing, but some reason it kind of captured my imagination. Maybe it was just a shot of the football field exploding, which is a crazy shot, and I shouldn't like it because all those poor people are, you know, I mean, granted they're football players, so maybe it doesn't matter, but I mean, you know, it's It was really it did what it was supposed to do. It got me amped for the movie. So
yeah. There's a vibe about it that has me excited. There's a few things like the football shot, or most of the time that Anne Hathaway is speaking, where I'm pulled out of it a little bit. But
right, sure.
Again, I just feel like there's such scrutiny around it because people are so hypered into a frenzy about this movie. Like,
yeah,
everybody's got to relax a little. You know, it's just a movie, and you can only be disappointed if you are this excited this early on.
Yeah, I mean, the things that are going to make the movie great aren't the things that they're going to put in the trailer.
I wouldn't think so.
It's going to have to be some of the character interactions and, you know, what they do thematically with the story. I mean, I could kind of go either way on Bane up till now. I think this made him a little bit more interesting. And
yeah,
you know, I think part of the problem, obviously, is that we have so many spy shots and, you know, random cell phone footage that I should never have watched. But, you know, it's not a damn fault, but... You know, this actually is the way that the director intended it to be seen. So,
right,
better be better than YouTube. So,
I'm excited. Of course, we have to wait until next summer. You know what we don't have to wait for? Segue to hear your top five favorite movies.
Top five,
or five of your favorite movies, however you want to phrase it, you know, because again, this is sort of a fluid thing. These movies may change from time to time, or maybe you're locked in right now. I don't know.
Oh, and this is going to be my five for the rest of my life.
Until the Dark Knight
Rises. Until I turn 85, then all bets are off. No, it's a fluid thing, and it's a difficult thing. I had a surprisingly difficult time coming up with a top five list. At first, I felt kind of bad about that because, you know, I figure I should be able to come up with five movies that I love that I can put on a list. But, you know, you get very picky when it comes to someone saying your top five movies and then presenting it in podcast form,
right?
Where it's going to be, you know, just sealed in digital bits and bytes for the world to hear. I had a very easy time with what I would consider my top two. Okay. Pretty easy time with the third, and then this fourth and fifth slot kind of. I juggled a bit. I could probably even at some point easily switch out number five at some point, but I'll stick with the five. I came up with five.
Okay.
I think that there are some running themes in these movies. And looking back on what I chose, I think it's interesting that none of them are movies that I watched when I was a kid. There are no childhood favorites on here.
Okay.
Again, like I said, most of the movies that I rewatched as a kid were Police Academy 2. I don't know. We didn't own a lot of movies, so whatever I recorded off of TV. So I ended up watching and rewatching a lot of terrible movies, which was kind of a waste because when I was a kid, I actually had time to rewatch movies. Now I don't really rewatch movies all that much, unless I'm reviewing them and I have to, you know, listen to the audio commentaries and stuff. Actually, most of the movies were movies that I came upon when I was in college, kind of that age. And then there's one relatively recent movie. So that's the setup. That's the scaffolding. We'll build on that. So we'll start with what I'll call my number five, and that's Woody Allen's Annie Hall.
Yes.
Which is a movie that I saw in college and loved. It was my first Woody Allen movie. So I have that. I think, so kind of a safe floor to get off on the Woody Allen Elevator Express to, I don't know, turn him into a skyscraper metaphor for some reason. Maybe a short skyscraper. He's not a tall man. But, it definitely plays really well. This is the only one of the movies that I didn't have a chance to kind of rewatch up, kind of going up to this. So if my memories are a little hazy, let me know.
This is the one where there's a jade scorpion, correct?
I know it's kind of an obvious choice in some ways. I know there's some deeper cuts you could go in with the Woody Allen movies. I mean, maybe I'm underselling it now because I don't know. It's a great movie. What can I say?
I think it's a great movie, as somebody who is a fan of Woody Allen, I think it's easily his best movie.
Okay.
I think it has that reputation for a reason. You know, Woody Allen is a weird thing because it's like, first of all, there's people who won't have any conversation about Woody Allen with you because just the mention of his name, whether it's they can't stand his sort of talky, neurotic style, or they object to some things he did in his personal life or whatever, it's like the conversation is closed. Oh, I hate Woody Allen. And then even amongst Woody Allen fans, you know, it's very polarizing in terms of what are his best and what are his worst movies. For me, I mean, Annie Hall, I definitely think is his best movie. And possibly, and this might not be right, I think it's maybe one of the two, if not the best, romantic comedy of all time.
I think that's totally fair. It plays a little bit like kind of a Woody Allen kind of greatest hits, just because it's accessible and it kind of hits all the things that are great about Woody Allen, in a great way. Obviously, Diane Keaton is amazing in it. The romantic story is not only funny and moving, but also kind of real. I mean, I think that one of the reasons it spoke to me when I watched it, because I was at that age when, you know, I was learning a lot of things about girls and dating and how things don't always go the way you want them to, and how on again, off again relationships can happen and stuff. Right. So it definitely hit me there.
There is a book that I have talked about, I think, on the podcast before called It Don't Worry Me, The Revolutionary American Films of the 70s by a British author named Ryan Gilbey. And it's a book that I suggest everybody read. And there's an essay in it about – he does it by director. So there's an essay about Scorsese, about Coppola, about Spielberg, about Lucas, about De Palma. And there's one about Woody Allen. And he really places Annie Hall – as this huge artistic turning point for Annie Hall, and makes a case for it as not just a great film, but a truly experimental film where Woody Allen is incorporating all these different styles. There's animation, there's split screen, there's characters addressing the camera directly, and there's all these different departures that I feel like, you know, being a little bit younger, you know, we didn't see Annie Hall when it played, you know, in theaters originally. So we saw, I think, some of the techniques that Woody Allen used in the movie sort of filtered through a lot of other movies that we maybe grew up with. So maybe it didn't have quite that same impact on us seeing it the first time. I mean, I can definitely appreciate all that stuff. And I like how the movie is constantly changing its style and its technique and everything, but is sort of consistent in its story and in its tone. I don't feel like it's experimentation just for its own sake. But at the same time, I mean, reading the essay, it definitely makes, I think, a pretty strong case for this being, you know, kind of a like a quiet revolution in terms of movies. And I don't think the movie always gets credit for that. I think it gets credit for being funny and romantic, and it's got the great Diane Keaton performance, and it's sort of Woody Allen's most famous movie, and it won the Oscar and blah blah blah. But I don't think it necessarily gets credit for being so sort of experimental.
Sure. And that same essay talks about, because I read, because you mentioned it on the podcast, and nice, I listened to the podcast, talks about kind of Woody Allen's original vision for the movie, which was much more broad, and the romantic story was just a subplot, wasn't it? And the original idea for the movie,
which was
supposed to incorporate other stuff, murder mystery, I think, and some other stuff.
Yeah, it was like a 3-hour movie, right?
Yeah, which is kind of insane considering what it is, you know. Now it's just, I'm glad that he, you know, saw enough to kind of just boil it down to this essence. And I think you're right, and I think that's a lot of that kind of stylistic stuff is what spoke to me when I saw it, because it was a time when I was really looking at film in a new way, you know, watching movies maybe a little bit more critically, you know, because obviously I'd left the videotapes of Batteries Not Included and A Very Brady Christmas at home, so I didn't have that stuff to watch. So this, you know, not only was it funny, but really really well made, and you know, maybe one of the reasons that it doesn't get as much credit is because it is a comedy, and maybe I'm being too hard on people, but it seems like when a comedy does things, it maybe isn't taken seriously. I know that was ironic, but
I totally agree with that. And it came out, you know, sort of in the shadow of Star Wars, and I feel like that's almost part of the movie's footnote too. It's just like, it won Best Picture the year Star Wars came out. Well, yeah. Did you happen to see that recent American Masters special on Woody Allen?
I didn't know.
It's getting crazy praise from people, and I watched it. It was a 2-part, so roughly 3 to 4 hour documentary just on Woody Allen's films, and people are really falling all over themselves talking about how great it is. I was actually a little let down by it. I felt like I didn't learn that much new. What it did was make me want to go back and watch all of Woody Allen's movies, because it's a bunch of clips, and it reminds you of like, hey, I really like this movie. I haven't seen it in a long time. And it really only told me sort of two new pieces of information. One was that Mia Farrow found out about his relationship with his daughter Sun Yi, which is obviously very well documented at this point. She found out about it during the filming of Husbands and Wives, where she was playing his wife on screen, and had to go back and finish shooting the movie with that new information. Sort of as their relationship was falling apart, she had to continue to act opposite him as his wife. Which is one of those things where I'm like, well, give Mia Farrow all of the Oscars. Any Oscars you're not giving to Tom Cruise, give to Mia Farrow. But also that the year that Annie Hall won Best Picture and Best Director, Woody Allen wasn't at the Oscars. And it's not because he was making some political statement a la Marlon Brando and Sacheon Littlefeather. It was because it was on a Monday night, and he practiced with his jazz band on Monday nights. And it spoke to, I think, how little Woody Allen sort of cares about maybe critical reception or awards. Or, you know, he goes and he makes his one movie a year, and then he puts it behind him, and it's on to the next one. And so there's definitely, I mean, you could definitely see some of that in his output, that it's like, it's all over the place. And maybe you get a horrible Woody Allen movie one year, and then a really great one the next year, because it's almost a blank slate every time. But yeah, I couldn't believe that it was just, it wasn't some big, you know, protest or anything. It was just his values were with his jazz band. He could care less about the Oscars, and he won the two biggest ones that year.
Yeah. Yeah. And well deserved. And that's why Annie Hall is number 5. Do you mind if I make all these long distance dedications?
No, absolutely. Right. Please do it.
All right. This Coming one's in. Going out to Mike and... I don't know. So anyway,
coming in at number 4.
Coming in number 4. This is another older movie. This is from 1968, I think. This is Mike Nichols, The Graduate.
Yes.
And if my discussion of it here is not thorough enough for you, feel free to listen to the F This Movie podcast all about The Graduate. which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com.
Nice, nice.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, this is such a great movie. And another one that I watched right around that same time when I was really getting into movies more seriously. And I watched a bit of it again today. And it is just it is so rich and layered and just dense with stuff. At the same time that it's really kind of breezy and easy to watch and just flows so naturally. This obviously the story, Dustin Hoffman, the recent graduate who comes home and he's kind of being hounded by all these adult figures in his life to figure out what to do with his life. And along the way, he falls into an affair with Anne Bancroft's famous Mrs. Robinson, only to eventually fall for her daughter. And he goes and breaks up her wedding, et cetera, et cetera. It's amazing how I can watch this movie as many times as I've watched it and watch it again today and just see little details, little things that I never saw before. Just watching the opening credits and, the scene where he's on the moving walkway. And, I'd heard it before, but never really registered that he's just kind of being constantly bombarded by these messages, these airport messages that are telling him what he has to do. And it just kind of repeats it over and over again. It just mirrors the whole, that he's being told and instructed by all these adults what he should be doing in his life.
Even the visual metaphor of him on this walkway.
Absolutely.
Just being taken somewhere that he has no, participation in or whatever.
Right, right. And cutting to a scene of him basically in a fish tank.
Right.
And it's just, it really is just kind of a masterclass in editing and acting, in storytelling, in filmmaking. It's just really an accomplishment. And at the same time that it's a engaging, moving story. There's so much you could say about the acting, about obviously Dustin Hoffman, I can't remember where this was in his career. This was pretty early on, wasn't it?
This was very early on.
Yeah. And he's just, so natural in it, and it's kind of hard to imagine anyone else playing the part as much as it's hard to imagine anyone else playing, Mrs. Robinson or the other characters. But
and of course, the original screenplay or the book sort of called for like a Robert Redford type. And so when Dustin Hoffman was cast, people were sort of aghast at the way that Mike Nichols had changed the interpretation of Benjamin. But yeah, like you said, it's impossible to imagine somebody else being so funny and subdued. And it's one of those movies that you watch it and you're just like, this is really a perfect movie and not a perfect movie in an easy way. I think there are movies that are perfect because they're sort of simple and they do their job sort of expertly, but The Graduate is incredibly ambitious, not only in its storytelling and the places that it needs to take you, but especially in the technique. It was doing things that movies really hadn't done. And it's amazing to me that Mike Nichols had such a command of sort of movie making language because, he had made a few movies prior to this, but most of his work was in theater. He was a stage director. And so it's amazing that he came aboard and had all these ideas for how to compose shots and especially transition from one shot into another in these really interesting and unique ways. And here's something that is strange to me, because I remember, Roger Ebert championed the movie when it came out in 67 or 68, and then sort of famously panned it years later when it came out for its anniversary. I mean, he didn't pan it completely, but he said he watched it. He couldn't stand Benjamin. He only liked Mrs. Robinson. Benjamin is whiny and selfish and blah, blah, blah. And perhaps made the point, I don't know if this was Ebert or this was somebody else, that the movie hasn't dated well, that its concerns are very much of its time, and that an audience watching it today can't appreciate it the way that they could in 67 or 68. And I understand it to a degree that an audience of young, it was definitely a movie that was targeted to young people in a way that movies really hadn't been, movies targeted to young people were the beach party movies at that time. Just sort of these rock and roll drive-in movies. And this was a movie that said, no, I'm listening to you guys. I understand what you're going through. It had the music that they liked. It had an actor that they could identify with instead of, Frankie Avalon or whatever. Not to keep picking on Beach Party, because I love Beach Party. So I understand that it was why it was so important to the young people of that time. But do you think that the movie can still speak to an audience? I mean, I think it definitely can speak to us, maybe just because we are movie people. But do you think that the movie can still speak to somebody who's not necessarily, you know, a lover of or a student of movies, but just more of a casual viewer seeing it for the first time?
I think so. I mean, watching it now, there's nothing about it that feels particularly dated other than the setting. And I mean, it almost works in the movie's favor to kind of have that abstracted a little bit more. It kind of points out some of the differences between the generations that I think are still totally there in modern society.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just not quite as heightened as they are in the film, but that's not to the movie's detriment. I think maybe adults now don't have the same expectations of young people that they did in the 60s, but I think that those expectations are still there. Maybe they're unspoken or they're a little bit more, you know, just felt by the fact that you're coming out of college, you're trying to figure out what to do with your life. And so I think it does work. I don't really see it as being dated.
Well, it seemed like the argument that was being made was that, you know, the movie is sort of about the generation gap, and the generation gap no longer exists, which I totally disagree with. Yeah. But I do think you make a really good point, actually, that expectations are different. And so I think there are some things in The Graduate that a young person today can't necessarily identify with because their parents don't have the kinds of expectations that the Braddocks have of Benjamin, you know?
Sure. But it's not really a movie about those expectations.
No, absolutely not.
It's more about it's about growing up. It's about kind of becoming your own person. It's about you know, deciding what you want to do with your life, or just kind of stumbling through figuring out what you want to do,
right?
And then maybe even deciding that you made the wrong decision. Who knows?
Right.
So it's about being that age, kind of in the in between stage of being a kid and being an adult. So I think I think it still works. I mean, Mad Men is a very popular show, not to equate the two, but I mean, I think just because something is set in a time period that is not our own doesn't mean that it can't speak to an audience, old or young.
Yeah.
So I think Graduate still works.
My wife teaches a film class at the high school where she teaches, and showed the students The Graduate recently. And she said when they get to the end scene and Benjamin is sort of rescuing Elaine from the church, that her students were practically cheering. So I think that definitely speaks to the fact that the movie still works, even though, and maybe this is true or not, that the movie punishes you a little bit for cheering for that a few minutes later when they get on the bus.
Yeah.
That look on their faces is like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have been so excited that they've done this.
And I was sort of shocked. I only got to watch about half the movie today, but I was sort of shocked to realize that really Benjamin and Elaine go on one date and then it all falls apart.
Right.
So he's really basing a lot of this off of, you know, one date that they had, which is, you know, I guess speaks to the impetuousness of youth and stuff, and maybe pays off when you get to that last shot, which was, you know, sort of an accident.
But because is he just idealizing her as sort of a way out of his situation, you know, or is it sort of true love? Obviously, the students in my wife's class were interpreting the whole thing as like, no, these two belong together, we're cheering. But I think there's definitely an element of that he's just sort of idealizing her because he's sort of miserable and stuck where he is, and she is in a way his ticket out.
Yeah. And not to I don't want to undersell the movie, but it definitely feels like, you know, this is kind of a lightning in the bottle situation where things just kind of came together in exactly the right way.
Yeah.
You know, what you're saying about Mike Nichols doing primarily stage direction. You know, I'm sure he came in with a lot of ideas, but maybe some of the ideas he had in making the film were ones that he came to because he wasn't already a director. He wasn't already kind of thinking in a mindset of here are the ways you make a film.
Right.
He was able to bring fresh ideas to it and do highly inventive things that, you know, aren't maybe as in your face as an Annie Hall, but are really, really kind of a revolutionary. And it's amazing how each individual scene just stands on its own, and you can kind of watch it and just marvel at all the little details and how kind of perfectly crafted each of these things are and how well they all stitch together to tell the story. And I think, you know, I think it still works today because it's a, you know, it's a compelling story, well told, and you know,
definitely
it's a great movie.
It is a great movie. If you haven't seen it, there's no excuse. You should see it.
Yeah.
Number three.
So we're going more in the comedy direction now. I realize that actually all the movies on my list are funny in some way.
Right.
Graduate, funny movie. Annie Hall, obviously a very funny movie. Number three, probably the most in your face comedy of all of them. This is 1980 something's. When was it made?
84.
There you go. 1984 is This Is Spinal Tap.
Yes.
The probably the movie on this list and probably the movie in general that I've watched the most times, because there was a period in my life, also again in the college age, where I just watched the hell out of this movie.
Yeah.
With other people, and it got to the point where obviously I, like so many people, could quote it verbatim.
It is an endlessly quotable movie. For some reason I was expecting this to be number one. Was it at some point?
No,
okay.
I mean,
I
don't want to put too much stock in the through five.
Absolutely,
list.
Absolutely. But for some reason, I thought that, I don't know why I thought that, but
no, it's fine. Yeah. I think there was a time in my life when this probably would have been number one. I have to admit that going back and rewatching it to talk about it, this was probably the hardest movie to get through.
Okay,
only because I know it so well.
Sure.
That it kind of lacks the surprise,
right.
You know. When you kind of start at the beginning of a scene and you know exactly what everyone's going to say through the entire scene.
It doesn't exactly have the forward momentum either of the other choices on your list, because it's not necessarily a conventional narrative. It's almost like an assemblage of sketches. You know, there's definitely a narrative to the whole thing, but it's more about individual scenes and set pieces and jokes that are sort of, you know, strung together in a way that works and is really funny, but it's not a conventional story per se.
Right. And I remember that the first time that I saw the movie as in high school, and it had been presented to me as, you know, this is this great, hilarious movie. And the first time I watched it, I didn't really care for it. I may not have been in the right mindset, but it was definitely a movie that the more I watched it, the more I got out of it. And I think that I've heard other people say that that's true. Hopefully I'm not alone on that, but,
it took me forever to see it. I didn't even know what it was. I mean, growing up, it was like a movie that I heard about all the time. But based on the title, I mean, you just have no concept what that could possibly mean, you know? Oh,
yeah.
And I didn't understand the concept of a fake documentary. And I hadn't really seen very many, like, rock documentaries. So I just had no frame of reference for anything.
Sure. And it's almost hard to go back now if you hadn't seen it, because there have been so many fake documentaries on movies and in TV that – even though this was, I don't want to say this was the first, cause I don't know, but it definitely kicked off a lot of the stuff. Certainly, you know, Christopher Guest, who has made the majority of the fake documentaries that have come along since. This is, I think, the best of any kind of mockumentary style.
Hands down. Yeah. Do you feel at all like, because Christopher Guest sort of years after Spinal Tap went back to the well and sort of built a career on these very popular mockumentaries, like you said, do you feel like he's diluted the brand at all?
Maybe. I mean, he's for as many of those movies as he's made, it doesn't feel like that many.
Right.
And I guess it's I'd almost think that a lot of the TV mockumentaries have diluted, you know, the mockumentary brand, if you will, way more than Christopher Guest. I mean, the fact that you have, you know, obviously The Office, and then you have Parks and Recreation and Modern Family, and shows that use the format, even though they never actually acknowledge what the why, whether there's actually a film crew there or it's just insane. You know, I think Christopher Guest movies have none have obviously matched This Is Spinal Tap, and there's been kind of a real diminishing returns on them. I think that. I don't know, was For Your Consideration his last or most recent one?
It was his most recent, and is technically not a mockumentary, right? Isn't that more of like a traditional? I saw it. I probably do not remember it at all. I feel like it was.
I'm kind of in the same boat. I wasn't terribly impressed with it.
No,
I think it was. There may have been some interview segments. I don't know.
Okay. I don't remember.
But And, you know, I enjoyed Best. I mean, Best in Show is, you know, is good. And Waiting for Guffman is good. And yeah, I think Mighty Wind I saw once. Yeah. I mean, they're all good.
You know, they solid. All have their moments, but none of them I think hold a candle to.
No, I mean, Spinal Tap is just so iconic. And it's another one of those movies where, you know, every scene is sort of this standalone gem. I mean, the fact that it's being quoted, you know, so widely, and is probably along with Monty Python responsible for most of the bad English accents of the 15 to 22 demographic. You know, speaks to that, and you know, watching it again, there are still, even knowing as well as I do, there are still scenes that absolutely kill me. The Stonehenge scene just breaks me up.
Yeah.
Every single time.
There are so many funny, again, lines of dialogue, and it's one of these movies. You talked about it with The Graduate, and I think the same could sort of be said of Annie Hall, even though I think it was almost after shooting had wrapped, maybe, but where it's definitely this sort of lightning in a bottle phenomenon, where it's like you've got just the right group of guys who had this great chemistry together, who were very funny on their feet because so much of the movie is sort of improvised. You had the right director in Rob Reiner back when he was able to make a really funny movie. You had sort of this original idea. Like you said, it sort of kicked off the mockumentary style of film. And, I noticed something, and we're going to obviously get to your last two movies still, but I feel like four out of the five, at least, this thing that they have in common is that they're all sort of, not to oversell them, but like they're all groundbreaking in their own way, that they're all pushing the form of movie making in one way or another. And this movie is obviously pushing comedy in a specific direction and taking this documentary approach, but it's also sort of an improvisational comedy. And there's just so many things that work about it, including the songs. You know, I feel like the movie wouldn't work as well as it does if the songs weren't good. Meaning, like, I mean, obviously they're kind of bad hard rock metal songs, but they're very catchy and they're well written songs and they're well played. And on top of that, the lyrics are really funny, and that's really hard to do.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, for instance, while I was washing the dishes tonight, I was quietly singing Sex Farm to myself because why not?
I've talked about it before, like Hot Fuzz maybe is a great example, or even Shaun of the Dead, where it's like it's hard to sort of make fun of something but also be a great version of that thing.
Right, absolutely.
And Spinal Tap does that with sort of these juvenile metal songs.
Yeah. I mean they are both great songs and very funny. And it's one of the few movie soundtracks that I owned and listened to a lot when I was younger. And it's great. I think one of the things to the movie's credit is that it is widely, you know, improvised, and there are a lot of famous faces and names who are involved with the movie, some in very, very small roles. But I think, unlike maybe some of Christopher Guest's later movies, it really does focus on just the core three guys in the band.
Right.
You know, you'll have Paul Schaefer, or you'll have Ed Begley Jr., or you'll have Fred Willard, but they're very small roles. They're not giving kind of equal billing. I think when you get to something like A Mighty Wind, where everyone's kind of on equal footing,
right,
you lose a little bit of that, you know, focus. Whereas this is just, it's just laser focused on these guys. And, you know, it also tells a, you know, rise and fall kind of very traditional rock story,
right,
that works. And
I rewatched it for this podcast because it's probably, of all the movies, it's maybe the one I've seen the least, even though I've seen it a bunch of times. But I think there are a few moments that are, I won't necessarily say moving, but maybe they're kind of moving. I mean, you do feel at times, not always, emotionally invested in some of the characters. I think Michael McKean maybe more than any.
Yeah.
But Christopher Guest also, especially at the end when he sort of leaves the band or whatever and they have their falling out. I mean, you do become invested in the characters, and I think that's the secret to making this sort of broad and silly of a comedy that lasts, is because it's not just about jokes or gags. The movie isn't, while it's definitely getting laughs at the expense of these characters. It doesn't dislike the characters. It loves these characters. And that is what makes it work. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily the movie isn't making fun of the characters. Maybe the movie is letting them make themselves look stupid. Does that distinction even make sense? I don't know.
I think so.
I'm coming up with this as I'm saying it. So,
yeah. I mean, it's one of those movies that stands the test of time.
Yeah.
Just as kind of great and really kind of loose and fresh, and really not, even though it's improvised, so you kind of get that anyway, but it's not quite as calculatedly improvised, if such a thing exists,
right,
as maybe some of the mockumentaries that have come afterwards that are maybe a little bit more self-aware.
Right.
And it's amazing to think that it's, you know, it's not even an hour and a half long. Cut down from, you know, how many hours of footage they had.
Right. Another testament, like Annie Hall, to the power of editing, because you could have ended up with such a different movie and one that perhaps isn't a classic, you know. Had they picked the wrong footage, or if Annie Hall had been 3 hours, we would not be talking about these movies, I don't think.
Yeah. So this is Spinal Tap coming in at number three.
At number two, penultimate position.
All right, this is where you could easily just switch over to previous podcasts that I've been on if you'd like, but stick with us for a while here. So in the number two slot, we're going to go with Rushmore.
Okay.
The Wes Anderson movie that I just recently got a chance to review, the Blu-ray, the Criterion Blu-ray.
Nice.
I'm really impressed by the transfer on that one, by the way.
I'll bet.
Very good. And this is, again, one of those movies I've seen so many times.
Yeah.
And again, watched at exactly that same moment in my life. This was just after college. I finally got a chance to see it. And I was living in Maine with my parents, but I'd go down near Boston and visit a friend of mine. And every once in a while, we'd just like rent a movie and watch it. And for some, I remember one weekend we rented Rushmore and watched it like over and over again. And so it really, I don't know, ingrained itself in me, kind of like Spinal Tap. It's just kind of, it's part of my DNA now. And it's just, again, kind of like The Graduate. I mean, there are very specific references to The Graduate in Rushmore. There's a scene when Bill Murray jumps in the pool. But it has that same kind of coming of age feel, that same kind of mix of humor and, you know, emotion. And the same kind of, I don't know, arc where it deals with sort of heavy stuff at times, but it does so in a way that kind of leaves you feeling, I don't know, good about it all. Probably more so than obviously more so than The Graduate, but I mean the ending of Rushmore is really kind of put together in such a way to make you feel really great about everything.
Yeah, definitely. But you know, not dishonestly so.
No, it's just a really great ending that kind of brings everyone's arc to a satisfying close. Nothing is cheap about what happened.
Right.
Again, another movie like, actually, again, yeah, kind of like The Graduate, we'll go back to it again, where music is really kind of key part to it. Instead of having obviously the focused Simon and Garfunkel stuff, this is a lot of classic British rock music, and that Wes Anderson is great at picking music, and this is you know, one of his best jobs of putting together a soundtrack. So. Yeah, Rushmore is a great movie. I don't know what else to say about it since we talked about it.
We did do a whole show on it. Yeah. yeah, I mean, it's not surprising at all that like this and The Graduate are on your list, because obviously Rushmore, I think, owes so much to The Graduate, not just in like plot or theme necessarily, but it's just, yeah, if you're the kind of person who really loves The Graduate, chances are you're also going to love Rushmore, you know, just because of sort of the vibe of the whole thing, or the music, or the photography, just the way that it's all put together. I mean, I don't necessarily think that Rushmore is, you know, stealing from The Graduate, but it's definitely, you can draw a very clear line from one to the other. And as I was thinking about, you know, the movies that you came up with for your list, that Rushmore was sort of the only one. I had said earlier that I thought four of the five were really sort of pushing the form, that they were all sort of these little individual revolutions in movie making, was the way I came up with sort of characterizing them. And Rushmore, to me, is the only one that doesn't feel that way, because Rushmore owes so much to other movies. I think it's more about celebrating some of the past instead of pushing things forward. And that's okay. I mean, that's not to say that Rushmore is derivative or anything like that, but it's definitely influenced by a movie like The Graduate or some of the French New Wave of the early 60s, maybe. That it's the only one that's more an amalgamation of other influences rather than sort of this own, its own unique thing that then goes on to influence other movies, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does. I mean, I think this is, Rushmore is probably the movie on the list that is in some ways the most personal for me just because of when I saw it and how I reacted to it. And it's the movie that I would probably be least offended if someone said they weren't crazy about it.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I'd probably, you know, argue with them about, you know, why it is a great movie, but I'd probably be able to say, well, okay, that's fine. It's not for you.
Right.
Whereas I think the other movies on my list, I would have a little bit tougher time maybe, you know, letting that go.
Right.
So was
Rushmore like, did you have a chance to hear the Mark Ahn show?
Yes.
Okay. Mark Ahn talked about Memento and how Memento for him seeing it was sort of a turning point in mm-hmm. terms of the way that he looked at movies or the kinds of movies that he liked. Memento was sort of the movie that set off this chain reaction. Was Rushmore that movie for you, or was it something mm-hmm. else?
I don't know. I think it just sort of speaks to my sensibilities.
Okay.
The combination of humor and the relationship stuff, just sort of that, the tone, I don't know, the tone yeah. of the movie, for some reason, like the way it all, I'm a big Wes Anderson fan in general, and I would probably defend all of his movies on some level, mm-hmm. whereas other people might just sort of not dismiss some of them, but there are obviously movies that are better than others. I tend to like all of them
mm-hmm.
for one reason or another, some more than others, but he seems to be on a very similar wavelength to me. Rushmore, I think more so than something like Life Aquatic, because that is so indebted to, you know, European movies, and in a way that Rushmore is a little bit more of a, I think like you say, a backward looking
right.
feel, but in an American way.
Yeah.
I don't know, but whatever it is, it's just sort of it hits a chord in
yeah.
me, and the music is great. Obviously, I'm a big, you know, fan of that kind of music anyway. And so just the combination of all the pieces, the way they fit together, I think is what really works for me. I mean, something like The Graduate is kind of an unassailable movie. It's just a great movie, but in
right.
the same way, the way the pieces fit together speak to me.
Right.
I guess everything on this list is going to speak to me because it's my list, but, but the Rushmore, for whatever reason, the Wes Anderson stylings, you know. It's me in a movie form, I guess.
Yeah, right. No, I totally, and we all have those movies, you know. That's sort of the way that I feel. That's sort of my relationship with Matinee that you were talking about at the beginning of the show, where it's like you see a movie and you feel like, boy, this movie was made just for me. Like, it speaks to so many of the things that I feel or that I think or that I want to see in a movie. You know, sometimes it's just a movie gets all those things just right. And, you know, it's funny because you had said, you know, there's a tone in Rushmore, but there's obviously, again, I think there's a tone sort of in 4 out of the 5 of the movies that you've picked, where it's like it's funny, but it's also a little bit sad or bittersweet, you might say. There's mm-hmm. usually some element of romance, but it's not always meant to be, you know. It's always sort of that romance that maybe doesn't quite work out, that there's all these sort of elements that I think appear in so many of your choices. So I think it's easy to
Boy,
understand.
I did not expect to reveal so much of myself.
Well, I just think it's easy.
But I think that's, I mean, I think some of that is maybe not as true now, but I, you know, at the age that I saw a lot of those movies, you know, all of that kind of, you know, romantic stuff.
Oh,
and
definitely.
Down to, you know, the comedic sensibility. I mean, that was all very much where I was.
Right.
And, you know, and still kind of, I still love, you know, I love bittersweet.
Yeah.
I don't like bitter. I can do sweet, but somehow bittersweet really kind of seems honest to me. Yeah. And and I think that the comedy is at its best when it's kind of taking an end run at a truth and showing it in a way that's kind of just straight talking doesn't.
Right. Well, right. It reflects the world back to you in a way that you sort of see it. It's like, this isn't necessarily reflecting movie world back to me.
Right.
You know what I mean? That this is a movie that is sort of playing fair and telling me some things that not all movies do. And that you appreciate that. I had something else that I was going to jump in with, but it's gone. Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
My fault.
So anyway, yeah. Rush show. So, excuse me. So Rushmore at number two.
Number two. And now the big one, which not necessarily your favorite movie, or would you say that, yes, this is your favorite movie?
Boy, it's going to be hard to say. I will give it a qualified, yes, it's my favorite movie, only because it's by far the most recent of the movies.
Right.
And I'd obviously prefer to have some distance to let a movie really kind of earn its place at the top. But
You know what? Well, okay. Just to delay the payoff of what number one is going to be, I remembered what I was going to say. You were talking about how you like Bittersweet and you sort of like these kinds of movies. And it's totally the reason, and this wasn't even that long ago, you said, you know, at a certain time in your life, these kinds of movies spoke to you. It's absolutely the reason that a movie like Garden State spoke to me in 2004, which wasn't even that long ago, but it's like, it does all these things that these other movies that we're talking about do. And at the time I was like, yeah, great. It's bitter and it's sweet and it's funny and it's romantic. And of course, in a shorter amount of time, Garden State has completely evaporated from my memory. And now when I watch it, I kind of get douche chills. Whereas movies like The Graduate or Annie Hall or Rushmore don't. My opinion of them has not changed over time. It perhaps is only – they've only grown in my estimation. Whereas something like Garden State, which is definitely influenced by all these movies, it starts to feel more like a hollow imitation.
Sure. And I think that was, you know, in a different way – true for me of Smoke, when I talked about beginning of the show, when I watched it, it really resonated with me, and I remember being really impressed by it. And now it, you know, I'm not in that same place. I think that was a time I was just, you know, just coming out of college, my art major, you know, stuff was all kind of boiling around in my head, and I was really into a lot of probably very, you know, pretentious thinking. But now I'm a more wizened old dude, and you know, I can see some of the seams. So
right. Yeah. All right. Anyway, sure. I'm sorry.
Anyway,
on to number one.
Number one. And I think all of the movies that I chose are what I would consider kind of really dense and layered. Like I said, you can kind of go back, and every time I watch them, I see something new.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many. There's little details and touches that are really you know, become evident over time. And this movie, I think, kind of trumps them all because it's so packed full of stuff on purpose. And this movie is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yes.
Edgar Wright's most recent film. And a movie that is, I think, so accomplished and so great that he could probably never make a movie again. And he would still be, you know, one of our best directors.
That would be very sad.
He should totally make lots more movies. Edgar, if you're listening right now, and I know you aren't, but if you were, then you should, because this is the kind of movie that you could just sit. And this is like, I mean, if George Lucas can sit back and just write off Star Wars for the rest of his life, and Edgar Wright should be able to sit back and write off Scott in a perfect world, in my world, in my head.
But again, in a way that sort of The Graduate, while being timeless, I said definitely sort of spoke to a younger generation in a language that maybe they understood or that other movies weren't necessarily speaking to them in. I think Scott Pilgrim does that for today's sort of younger generation. I think the first, absolutely. I think it's timeless in so much of what it's saying. But I think it has a new language almost. I won't say that, you know, Edgar Wright has invented a new movie language, but in some ways he has. And I think, you know, I had said that all of your movies were sort of pushing things forward or carving out new spaces for themselves. And I think it's too soon for us to know really what the impact of Scott Pilgrim versus the World will be. But I think 10 years from now, I think it's a movie that people will point to and say that it was a huge influence on a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that's true. It does seem in some ways, even though it just really speaks to the time that we're in of just the melding of media from internet and TV and movies and video games and pop culture and all these things. It does feel ahead of its time.
Yeah.
In a way that no one could watch it and then go out the next year and, you know, make a movie that feels like it and probably have that movie work. Because it balances and juggles all these really kind of complex filmmaking techniques and audio cues, and it's just so kind of well constructed and carefully constructed and considered that it's it'd be very difficult to replicate. So I think you're right. I think that definitely has changed the way movies can tell a story.
Yeah.
By taking lessons from what has become very, you know, ubiquitous in everyday life for, you know, everyone. Well, we'll say everyone under a certain age, even though I know that's selling a lot of people over a certain age short. But a lot of the credit for the way the story is told goes to the Brian Lee O'Malley, who right. did the original graphic novel. But Edgar Wright, I think, managed to translate it to film in a way that improves on the source material in many ways by adding very specific, you know, film elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
The audio is just – I mean, there's so many things to love about the movie, but just watching it again, it's just – I'm so impressed by just the little audio touches that he throws in. It can just be a little tiny, you know, less than a second cue, but because – you know, the person watching it, me, knows that, oh, that's the sound from a, you know, Windows 95 startup or something like right. that. Just a little, it's just enough to kind of trigger just the right switch in my brain to make me draw the right emotional associations with the characters.
Right.
Go ahead.
Just another one of those movies like we talked about where you watch it and you feel like this movie is made just for me. I mean, obviously, you know, that's not the case, but it's like, there are so many specific references to the things you know or love, or it's reflecting the world back to you in a way that you sort of have always viewed it. And it's like, oh my gosh, somebody else sees things the way that I do or the way that I want, you know, other people to see it. It's definitely one of those movies that just, it feels so personal, which is so strange because I think, you know, a lot of people didn't give it a chance because they thought it was all flash and not personal at all, you know, that it was just about movement and noise and like emo bands. And that's a shame.
Yeah. And I mean, it's easy to talk a lot about the details, you know, that make up the movie, but just at its core, it's a very, you know, well-made, well-told, you know, story. And it does pretty much everything it tries to do really, really, really well. I mean, there are really thrilling. They're amazingly thrilling fight sequences in it. Great action. I think a pretty compelling romance. Great performances. The music is, you know, great.
Yeah.
And just even just kind of as a musical, and it's not really a musical, but you know, just,
well, it is, except that instead of songs, there's fight scenes. You know,
right, basically, right. And there's also songs.
So
there's
both. Right. I still sort of contend, and we had this discussion via email and on our Scott Pilgrim versus the World podcast. I still feel like if you've watched the Blu-ray or the DVD, that there's an alternate ending that for me still is the better ending. And it still breaks my heart to know that that's not the real ending of the movie. But I mean, that's, you know,
that's fair. And I actually watching it again now, you know, probably a year after I watched it last, I got a little bit more of that sense that the way the movie was going might have made more sense if it went the other way. But I think there's still issues with that other one, with the other ending. And
yeah, there are. There's
something kind of in between. I mean, the graphic novel ended in kind of a whole other way, too.
Oh, because okay.
the movie was written in some ways in concert with the graphic novel. Edgar Wright was working on working on the screenplay at the same time Brian Lee O'Malley was working on the graphic novels. So they were making the movie. They'd finished the script before the comic book series was done.
Right.
So they didn't know how that was going to end.
Right.
And which is a whole other kind of interesting, you know, wrinkle to the story, because normally you have an adaptation of a source material. You have a book and then it's option and then it becomes a movie and then the movie does things and, you know, maybe the book's not as good as the book and stuff. But this was kind of being done at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, unique, and I think kind of speaks to the kind of fluid, collaborative way, you know, art's created now. And I think it's I think it's great that we have a movie. I think one of the revolutionary things about the movie, and it's kind of part of what we were talking about the language that it speaks, is that it doesn't kind of – it's not in your face about making references that might be considered kind of geeky.
Right.
Usually when there's some sort of movie or TV reference to someone who could be called a geek, it's very obvious. And they're very kind of a set apart and like, this is the geek stuff. This is Big Bang Theory. So
right.
The geeks,
or whatever. He's dressed like a hobbit.
Right. Exactly. And this movie just kind of takes it as read that, you know, the people who are watching this are going to get this stuff. It's not, right. You know, you're not geeks. You're just normal people who do all this stuff. And, you know, other people don't get you, but I totally get you. And and then it just goes from there. It's like it just speaks the language of people who, you know, are watching the movie and right. Make a big deal out of it.
Because it's speaking Edgar Wright's language, but it's not right. But it's not necessarily about – that's one of the things I love about the movie is that it's like, you know, there are filmmakers who make movies where it's like, this is a look inside the way my brain works. But even somebody like Tarantino, and I like Tarantino and I like a lot of his movies, sometimes his movies are about, see the way my brain works, see what's going on in my head, where he's calling attention to his sort of references or the way that he mashes up genres. And I feel like Edgar Wright, in particular with Scott Pilgrim versus the World, doesn't need to call attention to that fact. It's just, it's told in that language where, I mean, while the style and the technique and the way the story is told, I think is so much in the foreground, it is, because the story really works, it is kind of secondary. And so the movie doesn't need to call attention to that, even though it's definitely one of the things you notice. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's definitely something that you come away from the movie with. And it's all about just those little touches, you know, that make you connect with the movie. Again, I'm not saying like, you know, there's a moment where somebody flashes a ring and it's the sound effect from Flash Gordon. And it's like, I saw that movie so many times as a kid. It was like, oh my gosh, how great to hear that sound. And you feel a little bit like, well, that was just, that little moment was just for me. And obviously it's not. It's made because Edgar Wright loves Flash Gordon, and it's made for all the people who grew up watching Flash Gordon. But the movie doesn't stop to say, hey, now we're referencing Flash Gordon. Get it? You know?
Yeah. It's a very joyous movie. And it's a movie made by people who love all the things that are, you know, being referenced, and just movie making in general. I mean, Edgar Wright is obviously a huge film fan, and in addition to being a great director, and the fact that that it's a movie that's a collaboration of people who really love what they do, whether it's, you know, the music and the guy from Sloan who helped him put the music together, or Beck who wrote some of the music, or all these people who put it together, to, you know, Edgar Wright working with Brian Lee O'Malley, who obviously loves and created these characters and the source material. Kind of everybody, just this hugely like crazy balancing act, this hugely ambitious project that should have kind of collapsed under its own weight at some point.
Right.
But everything is just held at the right, you know, level of suspension that it just balances out perfectly on the head of a pin. It's in my head. This is a pin, and they're all balanced out. It's huge thing. But it's just I don't know. I mean, to me, it's one of the perfect movies. And I just love it. I love it.
And it's interesting because it is in so many ways a culmination of the other movies that you've talked about, I think, in terms of incorporating some of what those movies do well, or some of their themes or whatever, that it incorporates a lot of those other things while still being, I think, sort of this evolutionary leap forward, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, that's the thing that can be said of pretty much all the movies that you picked, is that, you know, none of them feel derivative or easy, where it's you know, they're building on what's come before instead of just repeating what's come before. And I think Scott Pilgrim, maybe more than any of the movies, is definitely doing that.
Yeah, and I don't want every movie to be Scott Pilgrim.
No, obviously. It would be exhausting.
It would be, but we have this, you know, just kind of perfect, whatever hour and whatever odd minutes, you know, of that thing, and
right.
When we have it, we can watch it again and again and again and again, and it's great.
Yeah. So, and you don't even want Edgar Wright necessarily to feel like he needs to top himself. You know,
I hope his next movie is a, you know, quieter,
right,
you know, Well, I guess it has to be. It has to be quieter almost by definition. Someone screaming. But yeah, I mean, he has done this thing, and it just kind of stands alone as, you know, this is Scott Pilgrim and enjoy. So I don't know. I don't know. Definitely. Again, I rambled about it on another podcast.
Yeah, everybody should listen to that. That
was my review. If you want, it's fine. The only DVD or Blu-ray I reviewed that I gave a perfect score to. This is my
interesting
perfect score.
I don't even know if I have. Well, I might have for Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
Which a teaser may show up on my list. So there's a correlation there.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Eric, for sharing all your movies with everybody and anybody who's listening. If you haven't seen any or all of these movies, you have no excuse. These are all movies that I think anybody who loves movies should see, would hopefully love, you know, may not form the exact same personal relationship that you have to each of these movies. But that's what makes lists like this fun, where it's not necessarily about, like, I think these are the five best movies ever made. It's movies that we all have very personal connections to, whatever those reasons are. And sometimes those are hard to articulate, you know?
Yes, they are hard to articulate.
And that's the kind of dynamic dialogue you'll hear on the Friday Filibuster. Every Friday, a DVD Verdict presents.
Consarded. I think that's going to be my new thing. You're here first, folks.
Nice. I like it. You have a catchphrase. I think you're the first
person. I need a catchphrase.
You're the first one on F This Movie to have your own catchphrase. So that is very exciting. And by the way, if Eric's catchphrase is your favorite moment on F This Movie, don't forget to email fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com and enter the Win Our Stuff contest. You can win a Blu-ray of The Rocketeer, courtesy of therocketeer.net. You could win Nightmare Before Christmas on Blu-ray. You could have won Uncle Buck on Blu-ray, but Eric apparently sold that one off really quick, by the way, because your review was pretty recent.
Yeah, well, you know, things don't last too long in the Aspersleger household.
In and out.
I basically live in a department store, so it's giant yard sale that I run year-round.
Blu-ray of Uncle Buck is off the table, but there's lots of other great stuff.
Maybe, you know, I thought I spied a DVD copy of House Bunny earlier today.
Are you sure you want to par with that? That's the acting debut of one Catherine McPhee, so reconsider that is all I'm saying.
Okay. Let's see what else I can find.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy holidays. We will talk to you in a week.